It's true. It's true. The Crown has made it clear. The climate must be perfect all the year. A law was made a distant moon ago here. July and August cannot be too hot. And there's a legal limit to the snow here in Camelot. The winter is forbidden.
Unmistakably, the voice of Richard Burton singing from the Broadway musical Camelot. The music from that was a favourite of President Kennedy, but it was Jackie who linked JFK to Camelot forever with her famous line, "There'll be great presidents again, but there'll never be another Camelot." So in this programme, as we approach the 50th anniversary of his assassination on November the 23rd, it's time for a reassessment of Jack Kennedy's legacy, in particular his very last year. In his final year, the world was in turmoil. Global war seemed likely, yet in the view of many, JFK managed to pull together the qualities necessary at just the right time to be the leader the world needed. To help me describe and understand the last year of Kennedy, we've got two very, very distinguished panellists. First up, Thurston Clark. Thurston was on the program, in 2008, talking about Robert Kennedy's last campaign in 68. He's currently, I think, on his 12th book, including three New York Times notable books. His Pearl Harbor Ghosts was the basis of a CBS doco. His best-selling Lost Hero, a biography of Raoul Wallenberg. And you might recall we were celebrating Wallenberg's life and times on this program just a couple of weeks ago. That was made into an award-winning mini-series. You'll see his byline in Vanity Fair, New York Times, The Washington Post. Lots of awards, up to and including a Guggenheim. Jeffrey Sachs, well, heavens above, how do I explain about Jeffrey? World-renowned professor of economics, leader in sustainable development, senior U.S. advisor, best-selling author, and a columnist whose syndicated works appear in more than 80 countries. And I must say, Jeffrey, I'm lost in admiration and jealousy. I've just done the maths, and my columns appear in one nation, so you're 79 ahead of me. Now, you might remember, dear listener, we invited you a couple of years ago to vote on the greatest speeches in history. And you were free to choose fictional speeches, the famous speech in Julius Caesar, for example, the Sermon on the Mount. I don't know where you'd quite put that in the fiction, non-fiction categories, on and on. And the winners, the short list of winners, included the Sermon on the Mount. It included Paul Keating's remarkable speech about our responsibility to Aboriginal Australia at Redfern. And inevitably, it included the Gettysburg Address of Lincoln's. I don't recall either of the two great speeches of Jack Kennedy we're going to discuss tonight appearing on that list or even cracking it for a nomination. But both Thurston and Jeffrey will be arguing for a speech of Kennedy's which they regard as absolutely crucial to 20th century history. Let me play one of those speeches, or a fragment from one of those speeches, to you right now. We call this the peace speech.
Some say that it is useless to speak of peace, or world law, or world disarmament, and that it will be useless until the leaders of the Soviet Union adopt a more enlightened attitude. I hope they do. I believe we can help them do it. But I also believe that we must re-examine our own attitudes as individuals and as a nation. For our attitude is as essential as theirs. And every graduate of this school, every thoughtful citizen who despairs of war and wishes to bring peace, should begin by looking inward, by examining his own attitude towards the possibilities of peace, towards the Soviet Union, towards the course of the Cold War, and towards freedom and peace here at home.
Now, Jeffrey has written a book, really pretty much on that speech. It's called JFK's Quest for Peace to Move the World. And Jeffrey joins me via Skype from New York. Thurston Clark focuses on what most of us have seen as Kennedy's greatest public utterance, his inaugural, and his new book is called Ask Not, The Inauguration of JFK and the Speech That Changed America, and he joins me now from Burlington. Gentlemen, welcome back to the Little Wireless Program in Australia. It's great to have you. Jeffrey, many JFK admirers see the peace speech as important, but you see it as nothing less than the most important foreign policy speech of the modern presidencies. Why?
Well, thank you for having us on the show, and let me say what an honor and pleasure it is to be together with Thurston, who is such a great scholar and has helped to guide us all in understanding the Kennedy presidency. My view is that the speech is not only magnificent, and I encourage everybody, every listener, to get online and listen to the speech in its entirety. It's available on the internet, easily found as the American University Commencement Address of June 10, 1963. It's gorgeous, it's eloquent, it's moving, but it also changed history. It was so compelling in how it presented the issues of war and peace that within a few weeks, it made a significant contribution, I would argue, to the signing of the Partial Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. It did that both by changing the way that Americans thought about the issues in this remarkable way, Kennedy asking Americans to re-examine our own attitudes. Presidents don't do that usually, but this speech bids his American compatriots to think again about how America views the Soviet Union, the Cold War, the question of peace. It also was compelling for Kennedy's counterpart, Nikita Khrushchev. It praised the Russian people for their valor and for their courage. It was regarded by Khrushchev, indeed, as the finest speech by an American president since Franklin Roosevelt, as Khrushchev told to the U.S. envoy, Averell Harriman. Khrushchev was moved by it. Of course, both leaders had been shocked and shaken and moved in this direction towards an agreement by the events of a few months earlier during the October Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. But this speech helped set the tone, the mood, the motivation, the reasons to finally conclude a long, elusive treaty. That's why it's so important.
Jeffrey, you point out that, you describe it as a true masterpiece, and you point out that the Cuban crisis had given Kennedy a new confidence in finding a new way. If it hadn't been for the missile crisis, he wouldn't have had the momentum or indeed the depth of experience to tackle this.
I'm not sure I would choose the word confidence. I think the crisis shook Kennedy to his soul. The same with Khrushchev. Khrushchev at one point was asked, "Were you afraid?" He said, "Are you crazy? I'm paraphrasing. I was terrified. Only a madman would not have been afraid at that moment." Here were two leaders who had experienced something that no human beings in world history had experienced. They were leading countries that came to the very brink of not only annihilating each other, but possibly ending life on the planet. They were terrified. They were shaken deeply. And I think it changed both of them. Kennedy realized that without his leadership, it would be impossible to secure peace. I think what both leaders found was they were surrounded by a lot of crazy people, if I could put it in the vernacular. Many of Kennedy's advisors gave advice that would have ended the world, most likely. This is a pretty sobering reality when you're surrounded by generals, by CIA officials, by even political advisors who are telling you, shoot first, think later, and you contemplate the meaning of that. My view of that the actual lessons of these experiences is that without sound leadership, it's not possible to find the way out, because there are too many points of view, too many hardliners, too many self-fulfilling crises, too many misunderstandings. And so Kennedy finally grasped the levers of power, did so magnificently in the final year. And that's why I think, like Thurston, I believe his final year as president was a year of true greatness.
Before we go to Thurston, let's just dwell on the writing of the speech. Now, I mentioned in passing a great Australian political speech, which you won't know, Paul Keating's Redfern speech. Since Paul gave it, there's been some rather ugly disputation between him and his principal speechwriter on who was the true author. To your knowledge, Geoffrey, how much of it did Kennedy write as opposed to Ted Sorensen?
I think they were such a close team. Sorensen was known not only by his official title as Kennedy's counselor, but also, in effect, as his alter ego. And so I didn't even try, frankly, in thinking about this, looking through archival material, reading, and so forth, even to make that separation. They talked constantly. They were together constantly. They channeled each other's moods. Sorensen wrote the words. He made the draft. He was a gifted, wonderful wordsmith, to say the least, but also he was an extraordinary human being. And I was very, very privileged to know Ted Sorensen as a friend and a neighbor. And indeed, when I first thought about writing a book about this speech, Ted was alive and we discussed it, and I looked forward so much to being able to ask him questions, just like the one you asked me. But alas, he passed away, and I realized I had to write it now or wouldn't do so.
Geoffrey, I understand yeah. that Ted spoke to you about his analysis of the Gettysburg Address, trying to find the magic rhythms and ingredients.
Not with me, actually, no. We talked about a lot of things, but I don't recall that conversation.
Okay, I know that he did make that observation to another. I'm sorry, I conflated them now. How did the American public react to the speech, Geoffrey? As we just heard, he was asking them to examine their own attitudes towards the Soviet Union, to look inwards.
The speech was received generally favorably, but not with enormous fanfare. A few writers and editorialists saw the import of the speech, but I would say more, for example, in the English press than in the U.S. press. There had been so many disappointments. The idea that Kennedy was calling for a new approach definitely made people sit up. But frankly, when I watch the delivery of the speech on video, what goes through my mind is wanting to tell everyone, listen, stop shuffling around, stop fiddling, you're listening to history. And I don't think that was appreciated in the immediate aftermath of the speech. So in general, the speech was well received. Let me be clear about that. It was not, though, received as a watershed at that moment. And indeed, I think for a lot of history, many connoisseurs of presidential speechmaking regarded the speech very highly, but I don't think that it got the due that it deserved. When I talked about this speech many years ago in BBC brief lectures, and Ted Sorensen was in the audience and listening to my rendition of the speech, at the end of the speech, when I went down, I got the highest accolade one could ever dream of. He said, Jeff, you got it. And then he said to me, this was my favorite speech. And he regarded it as the most important. And I agree with that, absolutely. But I don't think that the newspaper editorials and the pundits could have understood its import, because partly that depended on it's the proof of its value in the signing of a treaty several weeks later. And then with the assassination and the fast flow of history, in a way, the speech remained well regarded, but I don't think properly understood in its role.
I should say in parenthesis that the draft of the speech wasn't cleared by the military, the chiefs of staff, or the leaders of Congress. LNL on Radio National, and my guests are Professor Jeffrey D. Sachs, Director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University, amongst his many hats, and historian and author Thurston Clark. Thurston, here's a speech that begins a process that will, down the track, lead to the end of the Cold War. And you point out that JFK could confided his fears to Khrushchev, who sympathized because, as Jeffrey points out, he had similar problems of his own.
Yes, that's true. I should just say quickly that most of the material about that we're talking about now is in my most recent book, JFK's Last 100 Days, that's just been published, which takes up the whole aftermath of the American University speech. An aftermath that's been largely forgotten now. We know that it led to the signing and then eventually the ratification of the Limited Test Ban Treaty. But what has been forgotten is that this was ushering in what was then widely called a detente and a thawing of the Cold War. And this has been largely forgotten, I think, in part because Dallas, his assassination, was such a traumatic event that it seemed to kind of lead to a certain amnesia about everything that happened in the kind of couple of months beforehand. Let me just give you a couple of examples of things that characterize this detente. On the 20th of July, Kennedy was asked at a press conference if the United States was going to continue the race to the moon. It seemed like the Russians might not be racing with us anymore. And Kennedy said, definitely, of course we are. Then within 10 days, negotiators had initialed the treaty, and the treaty was signed beginning of August. 3 weeks later, Kennedy had an extraordinary private meeting with the Russian ambassador to Washington, Dobrynin. We know about it because Kennedy secretly taped the meeting. And during this meeting, you hear Dobrynin, first of all, he reads a letter from Khrushchev, which is very conciliatory, but pushes Kennedy for more agreement. He says, we can't let this good start by us now just kind of fade away. And finally, Dobrynin pushes and pushes, and Kennedy's backing off because he wants to get the treaty ratified by Congress before he, you know, follows that up with a bunch of other things. Finally, Kennedy says to him, well, how about if we cooperate in space? And then he makes Kennedy, the great man for beating the Russians to the moon, says, well, you know, the space race, a lot of these things are just prestige projects. They're three-day wonders. They're not really important. Why don't we get together and go to the moon together? And Dobrynin is surprised by this, as is Llewellyn Thompson, who was at the meeting taking notes. And then Kennedy gives a speech which has been largely forgotten on the 20th of September to the United Nations General Assembly that leads to huge black headlines in the New York Times. It was a speech that he kept carefully a secret from most of his advisors. It surprised them as much as anybody else. And he announces that he's going to ask the Soviets to join us on the moon. He's proposing a joint moon mission. This was just one of a number of other things that led to this detente. There was the wheat deal. Kennedy agreed to sell wheat, surplus wheat, to the Soviet Union. For example, also in September, our Secretary of State, Dean Rusk, said to Russian Soviet Secretary Gromyko at the UN, let's go and take a walk together. They drove out to the suburbs of New York, walked along a road where there were no interpreters, no one to overhear them, and Rusk said, President Kennedy wants to reduce U.S. forces in Western Europe. And he wants to talk to you about, he wants to discuss that with Khrushchev, but we can't let our allies know because it would upset them. Again, in October, British Foreign Secretary Sir Alec Douglas Home tells reporters, quote, we have begun the process of reaching a detente with the Soviet Union, and then he tells the General Assembly that we are witnessing the beginning of the end of the Cold War. And so a lot of this proceeded from the Limited Test Ban Treaty and from the speech, the American University speech. Kennedy had a meeting with Gromyko in October, in which they went over this same ground, and Gromyko again was pushing for more agreements. They decided to have a direct air route between New York and Moscow, and consulates in Chicago and in then Leningrad. And this was not, there was more to come. Kennedy planned, and Khrushchev planned, to have a summit meeting in Moscow in the winter of 1964. Just to finish this little the discussion of this, what I call it, the forgotten détente, at Kennedy's funeral, Jackie took the hand of the Soviet delegate, the principal and deputy premier McCoyan, and said to him, "Tell Mr. Khrushchev for me that I think he and my husband together could have brought peace to the world. And now Mr. Khrushchev will have to do it alone." A comment which also speaks
That's a deeply affecting sentence, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it also speaks volumes about her low regard for President Johnson, a low regard which is actually confirmed just a few years ago in Ted Sorensen's memoirs, in which he says that he sent a copy of his 1965 book, Kennedy, to Jackie Kennedy for comments, and she eliminated every single favorable comment about Johnson and wrote in the margin, "Ted, you must know as well as I the president's diminishing regard for Lyndon Johnson in 1963. He was truly scared about the prospect of a Johnson presidency."
This is Alan L. on RN, and my guests are Jeffrey Sachs and Thurston Clark. I want to go back to the importance of the political speech. One can observe at the moment in this country, Jeffrey, an almost, not simply a skepticism, but almost a cynicism about political speechifying. The more eloquent the speech, it seems to me very often the more philistine the response, and one observes that to some extent in American politics, and the lack of ability of any of the Republican candidates, you know, to lay a glove on Obama. But on the other hand, the fact that Obama, this pretty good of a speech on, you know, with wind assistance on a lucky day, is often reviled for simply being great at speeches.
I think you make a very good point. A speech without follow-through and without practical ideas can be worse than no speech. And I sometimes feel that with President Obama, who indeed is a good speechwriter, but there's very little follow-through. Kennedy was in his peacemaking, both eloquent and wise and clever to the extreme in how this speech is constructed. But he also had in mind some very, very practical things, and he was a good and effective negotiator with a timeline and, as Thurston has said, an idea of further rollout of ideas and proposals that would follow the partial nuclear test ban treaty. A great politician, in other words, puts the pieces together. Speeches are extraordinarily important. Public opinion counts, reaching one's adversary counts, moving the U.S. public in our constitutional system so that you get ratification of the treaty is essential. Kennedy always had in mind the utter debacle of Woodrow Wilson proposing the League of Nations and then failing to have the Treaty of Versailles ratified. And Kennedy was very worried, of course, that the Partial Nuclear Test Ban Treaty would face a similar fate. So he was acting at many different levels and with many different audiences in designing the speech. But most importantly, to answer your question, he was aiming for something very specific and very practical here, as well as something very grand. And it's that combination which makes this speech as powerful as it is.
Thurston, you write that there'd been poetry in his early speeches, but it wasn't until June 63 that he finally began to hit his stride. And you say this, governing from the heart as well as the head, harnessing poetry to the power of the presidency without checking the thickness of the political ice. That's another very important part of the Kennedy story, isn't it? That he was courageous as well as immensely practical.
Yes, I think that the Cuban Missile Crisis had, as Jeffrey's already mentioned, had a huge effect on him and on Khrushchev. And the civil rights speech that he gave the day after the American University speech, he was very much affected by the brutal suppression of demonstrators in Birmingham in the spring of 63. The inaugural address was seen by many as being this chest-thumping Cold War speech, because we remember the bear any burden, pay any price, bear any burden passage that began it. But in point of fact, the inaugural address spent a lot more, in the inaugural address, Kennedy spent a lot more time talking about negotiations, the danger of nuclear war, and peace. He said, let us never negotiate out of fear, but never let us fear to negotiate. And the newspapers at the time got it right. All of the headlines were, Kennedy gives peace speech. Kennedy holds out olive branch. Kennedy's great peace speech. So there is a connection between the inaugural address and the American University speech. He was finally making good on some of the things that he had said in his inaugural address in the American University speech. Also, you mentioned the poetry and power. That's a line from a poem that Robert Frost wrote to deliver at the inauguration, and he was unable to do so because of the glare from the snowbanks and the bright sun. So he recited a poem from memory. He brought the poem that he had written to the White House 2 days later, recited it for Kennedy, and gave it to him. And there was the last line talked about a new age of poetry and power, of which this noonday is the beginning hour. Now, as Frost left his meeting with Kennedy, he said to him, poetry and power is the formula for another Augustan age. He said, don't be afraid of power. And then he said, be more Irish than Harvard. Kennedy then wrote him a thank you note 2 days later, and he said, below it, he said, it's poetry and power all the way. But as I say in my book, JFK's Last 100 Days, it wasn't until he delivered these two speeches in the spring, in June of 1963, that he married the power of the presidency to the poetry of his words.
LNL on RN, and as we approach the 50th anniversary of his assassination, we're discussing the final year, fundamentally, of Kennedy's life with Thurston Clark and Jeffrey Sachs. Jeffrey, the limited nuclear test ban treaty, the proudest achievement of his presidency?
I think so. The two great achievements were this and preparing the way, though posthumously, for the civil rights legislation. And indeed, the Partial Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, as a very specific treaty, was less important than the treaty that it helped make possible 5 years later, the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. In other words, Kennedy set in motion, or helped set in motion, two extraordinarily important processes, and in such a fascinating manner, did so on back-to-back speeches, which are two of the greatest of modern history, on peace and on civil rights, and exactly marrying these incredible themes of ethics and morality to the absolute core of the exercise of power. And so, yes, from a foreign policy point of view, without question, the Partial Nuclear Test Ban Treaty was his greatest achievement. I think one thing that bears keeping in mind, at least my own view of this, is that as Thurston said, Kennedy came into office absolutely intent on finding a way to peace, but the first 2 years were almost exactly the opposite of it, and he bungled a lot of things. Of course, the Bay of Pigs was a disaster.
One's got to mention Vietnam in passing.
Well, and I don't think Vietnam was Kennedy's disaster. It might have been. This is one of the great unknowns. Of course, Kennedy was torn throughout his whole administration and what he would do in Vietnam. And there were, of course, so-called advisors, special forces, secret operations, the incredible blunder, in my view, of the coup that Kennedy essentially signed on to or reluctantly allowed to happen. That was a disaster towards the end of his life and the end of the presidency. I would take the view that he would never have let the Johnson-scale Vietnam disaster happen. He was much smarter than that and much more determined to find a way around it, and Johnson absolutely wrecked this issue, wrecked his presidency, and did great damage to America by the path that he took. I don't think Kennedy ever would have taken that path.
Thurston, you also celebrate Kennedy's great achievement in getting LTBT past the Senate, but you make an interesting point that forcing the treaty through came at the expense of a concerted push on civil rights legislation. You say it was a choice between ethics and history, and JFK chose history.
Yes, there's two things that I mentioned in my book. One is he had done a deal earlier in his presidency with Senate Minority Leader Everett Dirksen, in which he had essentially squashed a prosecution of Eisenhower's friend and former advisor Sherman Adams for tax evasion. And as a result of that, Dirksen had told Kennedy 2 years before that you have money, you have coin in my bank and in Eisenhower's bank too. In other words, he could call on them for one favor. When he had a conversation with Dirksen on the 12th of August, shortly after his son died, they took a walk in the Oval, in the garden. They left the Oval Office where their recording devices. Kennedy was always a little worried that somebody might be recording him. He was recording other people, but he was a little nervous about that J. Edgar Hoover or somebody might have figured out a way to bug the Oval Office. So he took Dirksen outside, and he reminded him that he had coin in his bank, and he said he wanted Dirksen and Eisenhower to support the ratification of the Test Ban Treaty. 3 days later, Eisenhower, who had been skeptical before, came out for the ratification. Dirksen became a very strong supporter, went on the floor of the Senate, and announced that he was going to support the Test Ban Treaty. Kennedy didn't use this for the Civil Rights Bill. As I say in my book, he could have called in the chit for the Civil Rights Bill, but he didn't. He called it in for the Test Ban Treaty. And also, during his last 100 days, there was the horrific bombing in the Birmingham church. 4 little girls were killed. And Kennedy never gave a kind of, never addressed the nation on that. He didn't send a member of his family to the funeral. He was quite muted. And one of the reasons that I talk about in the book, or several of the reasons, were that that same week he was going to give his speech at the UN and propose a joint moon mission. And he was also going to address the nation to try to build support behind his tax cut. And so he put civil rights really went behind these other two concerns. Later, he did get the Civil Rights Bill through, before he was assassinated, through the House Judiciary Committee. It was going to be on the floor, but there was a long fight ahead. I think for Kennedy, he saw his path to greatness as settling the Cold War. I mean, Kennedy faced, when in the summer of 1963, there were two threats to the Republic. One was a nuclear war, and the other was race war or racial conflict. And Kennedy addressed these two threats in these two speeches. But I think he felt that his road to immortality, to a great judgment from the high court of history, would come by settling the Cold War.
Yeah, how fascinating. Jeffrey, this brings me to what's happening today. How pertinent are the JFK speeches now? And what are some of the lessons that could be applied to the 21st century? And of course, we're talking on a day when the most appalling things are happening in Egypt, when the death toll in Iraq, which nobody even bothers to comment on at the moment, are even higher. I mean, the world's in a terrible mess. What does JFK say to our century?
One thing that really shakes me in the last couple of days is that as this extraordinarily violent and bloody and grotesque military crackdown in Egypt takes hold, what do we hear from the President of the United States? Not a single word, not a murmur, only no change of policy. We've got to keep those military arms flowing. Of course, I'm not expecting a grand speech, but I am expecting some coherence of foreign policy, and we don't have any right now. So,
after the Cairo speech, which everyone applauded wildly, he does have responsibility to return to the area.
Well, the Cairo speech was a very fine speech, and it's one of those cases, I know it close up, there was no follow-through.
Yeah.
The Cairo speech actually called for specific initiatives, initiatives in which I professionally have an oar in the water on science, technology, sustainable development in the region. And I can tell you the United States government absolutely didn't budge at all. Maybe they had a couple meetings somewhere around the region for a couple of years, but basically give a historic speech, follow it up with nothing, you end up worse than you started. So this is what we were speaking about before. Speeches are powerful, and they can make a big difference, but there has to be a policy alongside them. And I find myself more and more disenchanted with U.S. government policy and with this administration, though I haven't liked any administration for a while, I have to say. So this is not meant to be a partisan statement at all. I thought the preceding president was perhaps the worst or second worst in our history, but this one is not successful in foreign policy either. I think what I would take out of Kennedy's last year is to, again, put the speech in the broader context. Presidential leadership. Leadership to solve problems. The complex problems we have in the world, whether it was the Cold War or whether it's our climate crisis or which is growing and extraordinarily serious in its implications, or whether it's the Middle East aflame, requires leadership. Of course, the leadership has to be well-directed. Kennedy's success, after all, was grounded on a fundamentally correct assessment that there was a true mutually beneficial path to peace for both of the superpowers. And one needs an accurate assessment and diagnosis of what to do. One needs to rally the public, and then one needs practicality. One of the things that I like in Kennedy's peace speech so much, I think it's among the most powerful pieces of management wisdom that I've ever heard, he says, by defining our goal more clearly, by making it seem more manageable and less remote, we help all people to see it, to draw hope from it, and to move irresistibly toward it. Kennedy was a master at defining the goal more clearly. Put a man on the moon and bring him safely back to Earth within this decade, or making peace with
the Soviet Union. That wasn't so much a policy as a miracle.
Can I just jump in? I'd like to jump in at your question about what leadership, what we can learn from JFK. I think we have to remember he gave a press conference on average every 16 days, a televised press conference. This gave him a chance to step away, not to communicate with people just through these great set speeches, but people felt they knew him. American people knew him. He could push the limited, he pushed the test ban treaty in his press conferences and the civil rights bill and a whole bunch of other initiatives. Obama has, how many press conferences he given? I don't know. Jeffrey, do you know how many he's given?
I don't know, but it's a very small number with long gaps in between.
Yeah, and this is something, I mean, this is also, of course, the incredible grief that people felt when Kennedy was assassinated, and the feeling again and again in the polls that were taken afterwards, people kept talking about him as if he was a member of their own family. Well, they saw him, if they watched the press conferences, they'd see part of the press conferences every 2 weeks. And he was magnificent at the press conferences. He was very good. He was, some people think, better, speaking off the cuff than delivering a set speech. And so I think that's something that a president can learn from JFK is don't just rely on this great oratory, but also follow up with constant press conferences.
Thurston, he was in office for 1,036 days. And continuously spoke about what he would do in 64. What would a re-elected JFK have done? And would it have been a golden age, as he hoped and indeed predicted?
Well, as I say in my book, of course, it's impossible to know what he would have done. But we certainly can figure out what he intended to do. And among the things that I list in the book that he intended to do, he was reaching out to Fidel Castro at the time through intermediaries. So I think he intended, one of his intents was to turn Castro into someone like Tito, make Castro the Tito of the Caribbean. Whether he would have succeeded or not, we don't know. He intended to bring the American advisors back from Vietnam. In the beginning of October, the White House announced that 1,000 advisors were going to be withdrawn by the end of the year. They weren't because after Johnson took over, he didn't follow through on this. And with a goal of bringing all the advisors out by the end of 1965. Look, Kennedy had said, not just said, but repeatedly refused requests from his advisors to put combat units in Vietnam. It was the one thing he would not do. And it's, of course, what Johnson did in 1965. The conversations in the Oval Office that have since been released, as well as memoirs by people like Robert McNamara, his Secretary of Defense, National Security Advisor George Bundy, Maxwell Taylor, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and even John Connolly, all agreed in various oral histories and memoirs that Kennedy is very unlikely that he would have ever sent combat units to Vietnam, since when urged to do this by his advisors, urged unanimously to do it, he had refused in 1961, in 1962, and again in 1963.
Jeffrey, how close was Kennedy to being a great president, or did he achieve it?
I think in his final year in office, he has every mark and accomplishment of a great president. The first 2 years were shaky. He neither passed his domestic agenda nor made progress on, of course, peace. His greatness starts with the Cuban Missile Crisis. He saved the world. I think that's a pretty good step. Of course, partly he had at least some responsibility for the world having gotten to that point. But his actions in October 1962 till his death were acts of, in my view, great leadership. And if one takes that as a base for evaluation and prediction, I think I would agree with what Charles de Gaulle said, who was did not give praise very easily. But again, to paraphrase, de Gaulle said that at the time of Kennedy's death, that he was just beginning to soar into the highest reaches, that he was achieving true greatness as a global statesman. And I think that's a correct assessment.
Thurston,
this makes it all more tragic.
What thinkest thou, Thurston?
I think I agree with Abba Eban. who I think said the put it best after Kennedy's funeral. He said that the tragedy is the difference between what is and what might have been. And by that definition, Kennedy's assassination one of the most tragic events in the history of nations. I think in the last year, Kennedy showed us what might have been. Whether he would have accomplished all he intended, we will never know. But certainly, he never intended to put combat units in Vietnam. He intended to go to continue settling the Cold War, to have a summit with Khrushchev in 1964. I think he would have passed the Civil Rights Bill, although I don't think it would have been passed, that he would have gotten it through in 64. It would have probably waited another year. You know, there was a very interesting Look magazine article that came out a year after his assassination, in which the four leaders of Congress were asked whether Kennedy's, what would have happened if he'd lived. And Everett Dirksen, the Republican minority leader, and Charlie Halleck, the Republican minority leader in the House, as well as Mansfield and Carl Albert, the majority, they all said in various ways that the Civil Rights Bill and Medicare and everything else would have been passed, that the programs were on their way to being passed, and they were Kennedy programs. Now, this is an extraordinary thing for these four men to say, because Johnson had just been reelected and they were going to have to deal with him for 4 years. Johnson was known to be extremely sensitive and touchy. And to make statements like this in a national publication, as much as they wanted to memorialize Kennedy, these were bound to irritate Johnson. And the very fact of having them, making them, meant they had to believe them.
You know, listeners will remember that we've had both McNamara and Schlesinger on this program discussing Kennedy and Camelot and Cuba and matters arising. But I get the feeling, in fact, my conclusion is we've learned a lot more about Kennedy from Jeffrey Sachs and Thurston Clark. Thurston, in the brief time we have left, let's look at Kennedy as a human being. You write about him with great tenderness and insight, and you see towards the end a maturation of him as a man and perhaps as a husband.
That's right. I think it began with the death of his premature son, Patrick, in August. The boy lived for about 36 hours. Jackie was in the hospital at the Otis Air Force Base on Cape Cod, and it was Kennedy who went with his son to Children's Hospital in Boston. Kennedy, who was holding his son's hand when he died. Kennedy, who wept for 15 minutes afterwards. Kennedy, who went to his wife's bedside and collapsed in tears again when he told her about it. Kennedy, at the funeral, was so upset he tried to pick up the boy's coffin and carry it out of the church. And Kennedy, who then went again to his wife and cried, and then finally stopped and said, "Jackie, you know, we must not let this an atmosphere of sadness take this to the White House. It won't help the country, and it won't help the work we have to do." This referral to the work we have to do made a tremendous impression on Jackie, according to her mother. And there were signs throughout the fall that the two had gotten much closer. I mentioned just 3 weeks before he died, Jackie took a friend aside and said, "I think I've won. I think we're going to be a couple." And there are all kinds. Her Secret Service agent Clint Hill noticed this. One of JFK's former mistresses in her memoirs noted that after the death of Patrick, they were never intimate again, even though she was traveling with Kennedy, that he had no interest in any sexual relations with her.
In the time we've got left, let me let the record show that he was contemplating his own mortality. Larry O'Brien talks about being led to the window and Kennedy saying, "Just look at the platform. With all those buildings around it, the Secret Service couldn't stop someone who really wanted to get you." And Thurston, it's true, is it not, that he was advised not to go to Texas?
Well, he was advised by Senator William Fulbright not to go. Fulbright was the liberal on foreign affairs. He was a senator from Arkansas. And he told Kennedy 2 months before that he wouldn't go to Dallas, and he thought it was dangerous for Kennedy to go. A month before Kennedy went, Adlai Stevenson had been attacked by a mob. He had gone to give a speech for United Nations Day, and afterwards he was hit over the head by a sign. He was very shaken by it. And, of course, during the election, 1960, Lyndon Johnson and his wife had been spat at by a mob of Republican ladies who had followed them out of a meeting. They were known as the Mink Coat Mob.
Really? If I ever knew that, I'd forgotten.
Yeah, the Mink Coat Mob. So they'd spat on Lyndon Johnson. So it was not thought to be a very welcoming place, Dallas. So, yes. But, you know, the comment that he made to Larry O'Brien and all the other comments that he made, this was someone who was always aware of the narrow line between life and death. He'd been given the last rites several times. He'd almost been killed in World War II. So he was, and he was, of course, very quite ill most of his life. He had Addison's disease. So he was always aware of his own mortality. It wasn't just that he was spooked by this particular threat of a sniper on a roof. He was constantly aware of his own mortality and ran for presidency at such a young age because he was afraid he was going to die young and he wanted to accomplish something before he reached 60.
And Jeffrey, many people on this program over the years have insisted that he was also looking over his shoulder at his own military, sometimes fearful of a coup.
Well, he had a long and bitter taste of bad military leadership and was skeptical all along, went with it for the first couple of years, was shocked at the behavior and near insubordination of people like the head of the Air Force during the Cuban Missile Crisis, who was rude and accusing Kennedy in the room of appeasement.
Mate, I've got to be rude, unfortunately. I've mistimed and we're out of it. Gentlemen, I thank you immensely for your contributions. Historian and journalist Thurston Clarks. What's your latest book, Thurston?
It's JFK's Last 100 Days, An Intimate Portrait of a Great President.
And it's published by Penguin. Professor Sachs.
Yes, Alan Lane, actually, part of Penguin.
Professor Sachs' latest is To Move the World, JFK's Quest for Speech, and that's published by Random House. Thank you very much for joining me, and thank you, team. Executive producer, Gail Basario. Producers, Chris Short, Anne Arnold, Mudita Diaz, Paul Gough, Lila Schooner, and here in Musselbrook, where I'm broadcasting, I'd like to thank Mike Pritchard. That's it for now. Stick around on RN for the news, and see you next week.
Exposing the corrupt. It's become one of the signatures of Tehelka magazine in India, as managing editor Shoma Chaudhry explains on the media report. But don't go thinking we're all about bringing down bent politicians on the show. We've also got cat videos, 25 pictures that will restore your faith in humanity, and other viral content from BuzzFeed. The media report. Download it from the Radio National website.